All right, here we go. As promised, we have that countdown to the six-day war, and now we're about to begin. So almost everything I'm going to tell you is from a very, very good book. Michael Oren wrote a book called 6 Days of War. What makes it really special is, by the time he wrote it, so much material had become declassified, so he's able to tell you what was really going on by the Arabs, by the Americans, by the Russians, by the Israelis. Everything became declassified. About 25 years, you know, things are kept classified, and afterwards it's declassified. So we get a lot of inside information of what was going on at the time. He writes in a very interesting way, where you feel the pressure and the excitement and jumping back and forth. So I highly recommend this book, and I'll begin. 8:30, about 200 planes took off from Israel on their way to their mission, which is we're going to talk about the preemptive strike in Egypt. While they're in the air, Air Force Commander Mati Hod says as follows. Look how beautiful this is, right? Only in Israel. It's a beautiful thing. This is the message that he gives to them over the radio. The spirit of Israel's heroes accompany us to battle. From Yeshua bin Nun, David HaMelech, and the Maccabim, the fighters of 48 and 56, we shall draw the strength and courage to strike the Egyptians who threaten our safety, our independence, and our future. Fly, soar at the enemy, destroying and scattering throughout the desert so that Israel may live secure in its land for generations. A beautiful thing. Okay? Flying out. Now, they flew low. No more than 15 meters above ground level. I had a student several years ago who was a pilot. He said, that's crazy. Right? 15 meters. That's how low the plane has to be. And Ilan Ramon, I don't know if you guys ever heard of him, he was the first Israeli astronaut, and he died in the Challenger, you know, when he was coming back. His son died in one of these training exercises. You think about it. You are traveling no more than 15 meters up above the ground.
How many feet is that?
45 feet. 45 to 50 feet. Which means you're hugging the ground, and he's like, oh, there's a little bit of a hill. You have to go up or you have to go right back down. You have to go like this, right? All right, this is how he said, and Ilan Ramon's son died in one of these training accidents.
And if you make a tiny mistake, you'll crash.
Right. Right. And you're going at a super fast speed. It's not like you're driving a couple of miles an hour, right? You're going at a super fast speed. Now, so they have to do this in order to avoid the 82 different radar sites that are set up throughout Egypt. Most of the planes turn west towards the Mediterranean for banging into the direction of Egypt. Others race towards the Red Sea, towards targets deep into Egyptian interior. Radio silence now has to be strictly observed. They can't hear anything. The only thing they can do is hand signals. They said in a problem, is mechanical failure, crash the plane into the sea. But no one can call for help. Radioing for help will destroy the mission. Okay. A great deal was known about the targets, the location of Egyptian jets, together with the name and rank, even the voice of its pilots. Information was obtained through electronic means, and some of it by good old-fashioned espionage. Wolfgang Lutz, who we spoke about earlier, gave Israel all sorts of information. We spoke about how he took pictures in front of the hangars with the planes, with the pilots. Israel also had a spy that was giving us real-time information. He was the masseur, right? What's the masseur? The guy who gives massages. We call him Seuss, but that's usually just for women. So he was the masseur of Nasser. So here's the guy, you know, Nasser's tense, he's sitting there, he's, you know, giving him a massage, and he listens to all of the directions, he's barking out, you know, so this Israel's got a guy right there inside giving information. All right. Almost all of Egypt's planes were on the ground at this moment when Israel attacks. Okay? The pilot's eating breakfast. Why? Again, unbelievable intelligence that we have. Coming from Israel to Egypt, everyone in Egypt expected the attack to happen at sunrise. Because if the attack happens at sunrise, the sun will be in the eyes of the Egyptians. That would be the best time to fight. We have the sun to our back. In their eyes, advantage Israel. So Israel knew that every day they're up circling from a little bit before sunrise, for another hour or so, in the air, And at 8:15, they're all on the ground eating breakfast. Israel attacked at 8:30. Okay? This is, again, is why you need information when you're fighting a war. This is why, according to the Ramban, there's absolutely no problem sending spies going into Eretz Israel. The problem was the report. But the sending of the spies, says the Ramban, was absolutely necessary. Of course you send spies when you go to war. You need the information. This information is what caused us to have such a fantastic victory. Okay. Now, waiting in IAF headquarters, Israel Air Force headquarters, you have Yitzhak Rabin, chief of staff. You have Moshe Dayan, the new minister of defense, and they are there with Mati Hod. The first 45 minutes felt like a day. Because until, it's going to take 45 minutes till they finish and return. From a 20-minute drive, do the mission, get back to Israel. Before they would find out if they were successful, 45 minutes, it felt like days waiting to find out if this plan would work. Okay, Mati Hod, head of the Israel Air Force, he was a kibbutznik who smuggled Holocaust survivors into Palestine after World War II. Then prior to Mechamet HaShifor in 1948, he smuggled a British Spitfire airplane in as well. And throughout battles in 48 and 56, he earned a reputation as a skilled, cool-headed pilot who was known for his bravery and brilliance. Now, strongest desire is to go back to the kibbutz, you know, work on the farm. But Weitzman insisted that Hod be placed head of the Air Force. Replacing Weitzman became the number two man for Yitzhak Rabin. Since then, he had been focusing all of his attention on what they called Operation Focus. And what is that? Refining focus. Israel was at a great deficit when it comes to the number of planes that we have. In order to be able to fight, we need to have a very fast turnaround. Any of you guys watched the movie that came out recently, Ford vs. Ferrari? Okay, I recommend it. Very cool movie. Okay, so you know if you watch any Daytona 500 like this, so the car has to go into the, it pulls over to the side, and they got the team that comes in, you know, they got the wheels, they got new wheels, you know, filling the fuel, you know, they get the whole team that works on it before the car can get back out there in the race. So you got that team to move as quickly as possible so you can get back out of the race. Okay. The turnaround for an Egyptian jet before they could refuel, rearm it with missiles, was 8 hours. Okay? Israel had to get much quicker than that because they had nearly the Air Force. They need to go in and out, in and out. Egypt, 8 hours. Israel got it down to, take a guess.
Half an hour.
8 minutes. Okay? Yeah. Okay? It was like the Daytona 500. Okay, whatever. I don't know how. But...
Wait, say it again, say it again.
Israel was able to refuel the plane and rearm the plane so it can go out to battle again in 8 minutes while it took Egypt 8 hours.
Impossible.
I don't know. This is what he worked on and this is what he did. So Weitzman is an educated person. Making fun of the kibbutznik, he says like this. He might not be able to quote Bialik or Shakespeare, you know, Weitzman said about Hode, but he'll screw the Arabs in plain Hebrew. Okay? And this is what he did. Right? He didn't use the word screw yet. But anyway, fine. The jets dove. They approached in foursomes and attacked in pairs, each making three passes, four if time permitted. The first was bombing and the rest to strafe, shoot with the guns. Priority given to destroying the runways. Destroy the runways, planes can't take off. Right? After that, long-range bombers that threaten Israel's cities. Then the jet fighters, the MiGs. And last, if there was still time, he took out the missile radar support facilities. Each mission was supposed to take 7 to 10 minutes, 20-minute return flight, 8-minute refueling. You know, maybe give the pilot a chance to take something, a bite to eat, and back out there. Right? In less than an hour, they're back in Egypt again. Okay, this is why we'll see. Egypt couldn't believe that Israel was doing it by themselves. They don't have enough planes to be carrying it out. So the propaganda we'll talk about later is America must be helping them. Britain must be helping them. Plus, they don't have enough. We know how many planes they have. This is ridiculous. They just keep going.
How many do they have?
1,200 planes altogether.
But also, Egypt was doing the same thing that Israel was doing, like we're doing to each other, like back and forth, like the planes just like
refueling.
Going there, and then
they just took
that
60 times as long. No, because we'll see. We took out all the planes before they can get off the ground. Yeah.
Why is it that they bomb and come back and go back bomb?
Because we have to refuel and put more bombs. We can't. There's a limit to how many bombs the plane can take.
They had enough time to do all this. You just not thinking anything about it.
200 planes going.
Yeah.
Okay? And then when they're coming back, another 200 planes are coming. They're going back, another 200 planes are coming.
It's like,
so it was non-stop. Non-stop. And there's Egypt's a big country. They have to bomb all these different military Air Force bases.
Yeah.
They have to fly through the country. This is what we're talking about. This is what they're saying. Look at the ground. They have to be detected. It's crazy what's going on here. Now,
well, these are the planes that were...
That are flying, yeah, to get into Egypt, not to be detected in order to do this.
So they trained 1,200 pilots to fly, like, you said 1,200?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it says, but I might be wrong. I'll see when I get to it. In this first thing, it said maybe 200 planes took off. Okay, now. Below, the Egyptian pilots were in a state of shock. They couldn't believe it. Say, one guy writes, Brigadier General Tashin Zakai. I stood at the runway at exactly 9 o'clock, ready to leave with the training mission. I heard the noise of jet planes at the very same moment that I looked towards the direction of the noise. Two super Mystère planes, the French planes that Israel had, they dropped two bombs at the beginning of the runway. Two additional planes were behind them, dropped two bombs in the middle of the runway. Two last planes dropped bombs at the end of the runway. In a couple of minutes, the whole runway was bombed. It was a complete surprise. I don't know, it just came boom, that's it. By the end of the first wave, 9 o'clock, an average of 25 missions are carried out against Cairo West, Aib, and Abu Suwair bases. Four airfields in Sinai, two in Egypt, and entirely knocked down. The main communication cable linking Egyptian forces in Sinai with the Supreme Headquarters had been severed. The most devastating damage, however, was of the Air Force itself. In little over half an hour, Egypt had lost 204 planes. Half of their entire force, all but 9 of them, never made it off the ground. Turn about before they go off the ground. The Israelis were stunned, right? Never in their wildest imagination did they think that one squadron of planes could take out an entire airbase, and that Focus's kill ratio would exceed expectations by about 100%. Right? They trained and trained and trained, and it was so much better than they ever expected it to be. Okay. In all, the Israeli Air Force lost 8 planes in the first wave, 5 pilots. One of the planes was damaged. Unable to break radio silence, was destroyed by an Israeli Hawk missile after it strayed over Dimona, not realizing it was one of ours, was taken out. Yes?
What did the Israelis do about the Egyptian tanks that were on the border?
We're not there yet. Okay. Only now, the first try completed, were the results made known to the headquarters. They seemed too fantastic to believe. It wasn't until Mati Hod actually debriefed the pilots himself, was he able to come in and say, a stone, just one, but an agonizing weight has rolled off the heart.
Oh.
Dayan wrote that, what do you want to say?
Wasn't there a story where it's like how they destroyed all the planes in the base? Like they threw a party for something?
That's some other stuff I'm not going to get to.
Oh, but that,
talk about that later.
That's this, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Now, 8:15, Dayan issues red sheet, 9:15. Issued the red sheet password, ground war is about to begin. Now the second wave of fighters, meanwhile, reaches destinations, 14 enemy bases, half of them near the canal. All of Egypt's radar sites, right? Now at this point, Israel no longer is an element of surprise, but they're still carrying out, they carried 164 missions in just over 100 minutes, and they destroyed another 107 planes while suffering 9 losses. Of the 420 combat aircraft in Egypt's arsenal that morning, 286 were destroyed. Almost a third of the pilots were killed. 13 bases were rendered inoperable, along with another 23 radar stations and anti-aircraft sites. At 10:35, Mati Hod came into Israel Air Force headquarters and says the Egyptian Air Force has ceased to exist. Okay. Now, here's the interesting thing.
I guess you can say that Israel started the Six-Day War.
It's called a preemptive defensive.
I know that's what it's called.
Right. No, I'm saying, I spoke about before that when Egypt closed the Straits of Tehran, that was considered an act of war.
That's true.
Right, I'm just saying.
It's like over before you.
But yes, but this is exactly, that's in the Torah. Havala Hargacha.
Yeah.
What does it say? What does it say?
Hashigo.
Someone's coming to kill you? You're not going to wait for to take the first shot. Only in stupid Westerners does that happen.
So we should just kill all the Arabs?
I'm not saying kill all the Arabs. I'm not saying that. I'm saying they're what we're talking about up until today was they already massed their troops on the border and they're calling for our destruction day after day. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, someone else has their hand? Yeah.
I feel like the war was over before it even started because Israel just took away their whole airway and all that.
Yes, which is definitely going to get to what Yossi brought up. This will allow us to have air protection of our tanks. Right? We can bring our tanks in now, and there's protection here holding our tanks. We have plan C. That is going to be a big help.
In Egypt,
yes. It's huge.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a little thing. This is huge. Yeah, yeah.
So did they end up deciding to bring everything down to Egypt? Did they split the...
Everyone's down in Egypt. Okay. This is the whole thing. We'll get to that also. Okay? Another pilot, Hashim Mustafa Hassan. He wrote as follows. Some 30 seconds from the beginning of the first attack, second wave planes arrived. We ran about the desert looking for cover. The planes didn't shoot. They merely circled. The pilots surprised that the base was completely destroyed. They had no targets. We were the only targets. Weak humans scurrying in the desert with handguns as our only means of self-defense. It was a sad comedy. Pilots of the newest, best-equipped jets fighting with handguns. 5 minutes after the beginning of the attack, the Israeli planes disappeared, and the silence prevailed and encompassed the desert, and the noise of the fire destroyed our planes in the airbase and the squadron. They completed their assignment in the best way possible. The ratio of losses 100% for us, 0% for them. One other person says, what was our problem? We were so cocky and convinced that we were going to win this war that instead of training for attack, we practiced our victory parade marches. Right? Now, here's what's going on. This is what happened, right? What does Egypt report on the radio? So this you have to understand. Arabs are proud people. And they're not going to report that they just got decimated in the first couple of hours of the war. So the United Arab Radio reported as follows. With an aerial strike against Cairo and across the United Arab Republic, Israel began its attack today at 9 o'clock. Our plane scrambled and held off the attack. Not just that. A total of 86 enemy planes were reported shot down, including an American bomber. Egypt's losses were put at 2. So now what happens? All the Arabs are dancing in the streets. Arabs are celebrating the demise of the state of Israel, because this is what's being reported. The radio is playing patriotic songs, interspersed with calls, return to Tel Aviv. General Riyad in Amman, with the news, said that in spite of the initial surprise, the Israelis had now lost 75% of their air power. And the Egyptian army is hitting back and mounting an offensive in the Sinai. Okay. Who was not present at the Supreme Headquarters? All of this was really going on? Nasser. Okay. Now you work for Nasser, and Nasser's nuts. Are you going to tell them that basically the Egyptian Air Force, as Mati Ho put it, ceased to exist? Not a chance, right? So Nasser is kept in the dark. No one tells him that the radio broadcasts, as what Trump would call, fake news. No. So Nasser's convinced. This is going great. Right?
But who's Nasser again?
The president of Egypt. Right? The one person who would have told him later on succeeds in Anwar Sadat. Okay? Anwar Sadat was a pilot. And he writes, I just went home and stayed in for days, unable to watch the crowds chanting and dancing and applauding the faked up victory reports that our mass media was putting out hourly. So no one told Nasser. Okay? At this point, Nasser is calling on every Arab to avenge the dignity lost in 48, to advance across the armistice line into the den of the gang itself. Tel Aviv, that's where we have to go. All right? Nasser's leaving the report.
Why Tel Aviv?
Tell you, that's, we don't have Jerusalem yet. Where was Israel's government in Tel Aviv? Okay? Where was Israel's capital? Where was Israel most of the people living? Tel Aviv. Okay?
Take the big
so,
city.
What?
Take the big city.
The big city.
So you told him to push into Tel Aviv?
Yeah. Because he's convinced that that's what we're doing.
But
he doesn't realize.
What if under his control, be under the army in general? Or
but he's the president. He's telling everyone this is what we have to do. He's urging them on to victory. All right. Now, the ground offense, we said the tanks. One of the heroes of the tank battle was a 39-year-old we mentioned before, Ariel Sharon. It was Arik Sharon. We spoke about him before. He led Unit 101. And he now starts leading the tank offensive. Azar Weitzman said about him in war, I follow him through fire and flood. Sharon had been compared to General George Patton, the ruling commander of the Allied Third Army sweeping through France in World War II. Like Patton, Sharon was relentless. He was daring to be reckless, impatient with caution and commanders, anyone other than himself. Now, Sharon, like Matteo, was a farmer turned soldier. He rose to the rank of Brigadier General, and in the 1967-68 war, he broke through the Egyptian defenses at Abu Ayla. The all-night battle combined with precision attacks by infantry armor, Tzanchanim, was a brilliant success. He had a reputation as a brilliant improviser. And all in all, 2,500 out of the 10,000 Egyptians killed were killed by his units in the Six-Day War. Okay? So he certainly made a name for himself. Now, at this point,
we were killed by who?
By Arashan's units.
This is a quarter of the...
Quarter of the Egyptians that were killed by his units.
Habago's unit.
What?
Habago's.
During the course of the war, he was jumping around from unit to unit. His units killed...
Some kind of...
Oh. Now,
he killed 10,000.
Now, what happened? Nasser tells the king of Jordan. Anyone know his name? King Hussein. Tells King Hussein... Because again, he believes us. We are marching through the Negev. You better grab what you can get now, because soon the United Nations is going to stop this war, and you'll be the only one left without having, your hands in the cookie jar. We are ready. We're conquering so much of Israel. I highly recommend you get involved. So King Hussein says, all right, I'm in. 9:30, Radio Amman. Hussein informs his people that Jordan had been attacked. Didn't happen, he said. Been attacked, and the hour of revenge had come. All right? Again, he doesn't want to be the one guy left out. The Iraqis assured Hussein falsely that their airplanes were ready in action against Israel. It wasn't true, but Hussein now said, all right, Iraq's involved. Egypt, Syria, Jordan, wouldn't be the only ones. Gotta get in there. Gotta get in there. So Jordan now decides they're in. Now, Israel did not want to open another front. He said, their troops down south. And therefore, they're instructed by Moshe Dayan. This should not be a war against Jordan. Okay, we don't need it. We don't have time for it. We don't have manpower for it. So they had some soldiers stationed there, and they could use handguns to return fire. Certainly no missiles, not even rifles. Okay? Try to keep this to a skirmish. Right? But... Now, Israel Weitzman, he petitioned to Moshe Dayan, let's already from the beginning, the way we're taking out the Egyptian airfields, take out the Jordanian airfields. Moshe Dayan nixed it. But when Jordan started attacking and sent missiles and planes attack Netanya, gave Weitzman everything he needed, just said, call for it, that's it, go. Now we're going after Jordan. And within 9 minutes, they took out the two main air bases in Jordan. Right, rendered it inoperable. Once again, taking out the runways, taking out the towers. They took out 20 Jordanian hawkers, eight other aircrafts go up in flames, including General Bull's private plane. They had one plane that actually rescued 14 pilots to take them to some other base so they can fly other planes. It's like totally decimated this place. Hussein watches the attack from his backyard. He has his two young sons, Abdullah and Faisal. Abdullah is now king in Jordan.
Faisal, no?
I think it's King Abdullah. And they don't get it. Every time they hear a thump, thump, thump of the bombs, they think that Jordan is bombing. Instead, they're actually getting bombed. So they're jumping with glee and loving the sounds. And King Hussein writes that he lucked out by being home that day because Israeli jets totally took out the palace, destroyed everything, you know, shot through windows. It's like, had he been in his office at Bassam Palace, was riddled with cannon rocket fire, he never would have survived. Only because he happened to be home that he survived that day. Okay? Jordanian official was so upset, said we fell, we were duped by Nasser. Not really, that Nasser himself was duped by his own media, saying that you know, where's all his MiGs? Where's all what's going on? How come I only see Israeli jets? Where are the MiGs? How come Egypt's not here? They said they have our back. Ain't that many MiGs left, you know? Like, he doesn't know that. Okay. Now, Jordan had from 1948 where we are. Jordan had Yehuda v'Shomron, right? Where I live, where your cousins live. So this is what one pilot writes, Major Aryeh Ben-Or. He was commander of a Fuga squadron, a rocket of Jordanians, he says. It was an extraordinary experience flying over Beit Lechem, Hebron, Yericho. The feeling that this time we're fighting on historic homeland. I didn't know that fighting there would release such powerful emotions hidden inside of me. Right? This is how a Chilani pilot feels. We're fighting for our homeland. Now, another crazy thing that happened. One of the people that's most famous for the Six-Day War is a person named Mata Gor. Mata Gor was the head of Sanhanim HaChamishim HaChamesh. They were supposed to be fighting in the Sinai. They were going to be drop parachutes, they were going to have an attack by land, by sea, and take, but the Sinai tanks were doing so well, they didn't need them. So they brought them back to Jerusalem. Uzi Narkis, who was the head of the Jerusalem District Army, he described after the war that the Tzanchanim Chamishim HaChamesh fell upon us from the Shemayim. So that the Shemayim in the south didn't need them, and they came here. Now, Uzi Narkis, he was itching to get back to the old city. He wanted to get back to the old city. And Mata Gor was born in Yerushalayim. And he says to him, when he comes, he goes, don't worry, we're taking back Yerushalayim. Like they both, so it's a matter of time to convince the government to let us, but that is for sure our agenda. We're not leaving, you know, it's worth not ending till we take back Yerushalayim. Now, again, what we have to realize is all of this is happening simultaneously. I'm telling you one place at a time, but if you are the Prime Minister, or you are the head of the army, you have to balance Egypt's fighting in the south, Jordan now attacked from the middle of the country, and Syria has been bombarding from the Golan Heights.
Yeah.
What do I do about that? Right? So this is what's going on up now in the south. The residents are living in bomb shelters.
Then, the south is more occupied than it is now.
South is what?
More occupied than it is
what
now.
What does it mean by occupied?
More people living in the south.
No. But they're just going to come up, right? The border is, they're coming up through the border. Now, Rabin wants to at least attack in Syria in the demilitarized zones. You know, but Dayan keeps saying, we don't have the manpower to fight on another front. So the same idea, just sort of like, take the hits, move them into secure places. We cannot afford to open up another front for battle. Now, with the worsening for Jordan of their strategic manpower, Menachem Begin and other Knesset members, now recently appointed ministers, are pushing Levi Eshkol Now's the time to take back the old city. Now's the time to take back Harabaya. This is it. It's an opportunity. Yeah.
Doesn't Syria just come down afterwards if there's no defense?
We'll talk about that also. They're just right now sending missiles.
Okay.
If we want Harabaya,
we didn't have Harabaya. And they're saying, let's go now and take back Harabaya. Take back the old city. Why should it be in Jordanian hands?
We want the whole city. Like we want.
We're out of everything and we want to go and take it back.
Or we don't want to have it.
I'm saying, because right now, well, why don't we have it?
We do.
We
have a small Rova. What does it mean?
We have the whole city.
Yeah.
We more
you
than
don't know
than
yet. We'll see. We'll see. Okay?
Right.
Okay. At that point, where we are now is Jordanian territory. Okay? This was Jordanian territory.
Yeah, said, no,
okay. Okay. And they're saying, go back, take back the old city. It wasn't until later that evening ministers managed to get through at Begay's request. They have an underground, in an underground shelter, they have this meeting. Okay? One cabinet member said, possibly the most important meeting about Jerusalem ever. Colonel Lior wrote, as a son of an observant family exterminated in the concentration camps, as a Zion of the Jewish people and a citizen of the State of Israel, I could not hold back my soaring emotions. Said, we've got to do it. Now is the time. Only at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 7.5 hours after Israel attacked, Nasser finally was apprised of what really is happening in Egypt. Think about that. How crazy that is. He comes to Supreme Headquarters, he sees his second-in-command, Amir, either drunk or drugged or both, running around screaming, depressed, doesn't know what's going on. Husni Mubarak, later on, goes on to become a prime minister, tells him, no, the Israelis, they couldn't do it by themselves. I saw American jets. I saw my own eyes. American jets, you know, we're doing it. At this point, all that's going on, you know who else is kept in the dark? Israelis. No one in Israel knew how well we were doing. Because Israel goes back to what we said last time. Israel doesn't want the international community to know that they're winning. Because if they are, what will the United Nations do? Call for a ceasefire. So right now, this is working out well for Israel. Egypt's declaring that they're winning. Anyone in the United Nations getting all upset about that? No. So they're letting the war continue, giving Israel more time, the time that they need to actually make inroads into Egypt. So the Israeli public, as far as they know, the worst is happening. Right? They are totally kept in the dark. And this is done on purpose, you know, for as long as possible.
Everything's thought out.
What?
Everything's thought out.
Yeah. Now, the one thing that the Arabs now could agree upon was the new propaganda. The propaganda was that, first they went to the Russians and said to the Russians, we need more weapons. Right? And they said, not just that, the weapons you sold us, you gave to us, terrible. They're faulty. There's something wrong with it. To which their response was, I don't know, expert in weaponry, replied, you know, the foreign minister. But I do know if the arms were given to the Vietnamese, it certainly proved superior to the Americans. Right? This is the time of the Vietnam War. So maybe you should look in the mirror, you know, if you're wondering about why you guys are suffering a loss. Then, so what do they say? Oh, British bombers, this is going on the radio. Taking off in endless waves in Cyprus, aiding and spotting the Israelis. Damascus Radio says, Australian bombers striking our four positions. They start telling Russians, you better move your fleets into the area because America's got the 6th Fleet. They're here, right? They're back in Israel. So this now becomes the new thing. What happens now is American embassies all over the world are burning their documents and destroying the documents because mobs are surrounding all the American embassies saying America's aiding Israel. Again, they weren't.
Sounds like Argo.
Yeah. They weren't, but here. Americans have been many of the wartime rebels were given minutes to pack and at gunpoint searched and suddenly deported. In Cairo, Richard Nolte watched an angry crowd gathered outside his office. We are burning all, repeat all, classified papers, preparing for demonstrations, and attempt to enter the building. Right? This is what he's wiring. Okay? Because these are the facts. They were given them, but the Americans were helping. And and tomorrow we'll conquer the city.
Damn.